Okay. I really enjoy being here. I'm fortunate that I'm an adjunct professor at three universities, two of which are in Canada, which produces lots of conversation down in the North Carolina as to how that can possibly happen. So if you have some money and a beer and want to find out, grab me later today. I'm going to talk about multiple block data, and I'm going to talk about a sort of a drug design problem, the basic problem that the pharmaceutical industry is interested in at the moment. One of the basic problems is we've got the microarray data, the genes, and then we've got the protein data, which we're learning how to measure at great expense, and then we've got metabolism data. That's what's going on in your blood and things like that. So we have these huge blocks of data. The microarray data might be 20,000 predictors. The protein data could be 100,000 or so, and the metabolism data about 3,000 or so. So we have these three blocks of data, and we want to relate those three blocks of data together. Unfortunately, that kind of data is just coming into place and is being held very dearly by the pharmaceutical companies, so they're not likely to give me or you, unless you happen to be in a pharmaceutical company, that data. So I'm going to show you a technique for dealing with that kind of problem, but I'll use a different problem to exemplify it. Multiple blocks. The laser, yeah. Two blocks, we've seen that. Here's our little regression problem, y in a block of x's. Here's multivariate y in a block. We're going to be looking at this problem right here. Multivariate y, a couple of blocks of data to predict y. Strange things in the zoo of data. You might have a block of data here, predictors talking about the columns and other predictors talking about the rows. This is what we call the L problem. And then sort of a really weird problem, the U problem. These predictors predict the columns here. These rows predict the rows here, and these predict the columns there. So there's some weird kind of functional things that are going on as people sort of collect these strange data sets. And we're going to focus on a fairly straightforward one here, although it does present its own sort of problems. Tables are ubiquitous. We've all seen two-way tables. And again, I mentioned clinical chemistry, that's metabolism data, things like that, protein data, gene expression data. And all three of these data matrices will be problematic in several ways. You'll have many more columns than you have rows, so they're indeterminate systems. And then our friendly analytical chemists, I hope there are none in the room, are somewhat crude about how they measure these things, and so these data blocks will have missing data cells in them, and there'll be outliers, and there'll be sort of non-normal distributions, things like that. So it's a kind of a crazy world. And again, we're going to talk about this sort of a problem. The psychometricians were looking at this a long time ago, back in the 60s. They might give a group of people, so people go this way, they might give a group of people psychological tests, IQ tests, things like that. So this would be test one, test two, test three, so forth. And they would want to know how all these blocks of data related together. So it's multiple blocks of data. And there are a few papers in the area of these sort of strange animals that live in the zoo, but I won't talk about those today. So right here, this would be person number one, person number two, down to person number n, and then you might have p multivariate responses on that person, and then this would be test one, test two, and so forth. So you give the same test to everyone. So there's a linking across this way, and that's what's happening in this data. Here's your data of interest, and then there's a linking up and down this way. These variables describe the nature of the columns. These data describe the nature of the rows, and then the rows and the columns describe the nature of the APEX data set. We're going to rip right through singular value decomposition, a robust form of singular value decomposition, and that's going to help us out as we try and understand a fairly complicated forestry, ecology, species profile kind of a data set. And we'll give a nice, easy example on wine tasting of the singular value decomposition, and then at the end we'll make a few comments. and I'll freely comment as we go along. Okay, this is the crux of how you figure out how to use which variables you're going to look at. So we have a data matrix, N by P, and the typical problems are the data matrix is large. So in microarrays, we might have 20,000 columns here and only a few tens of rows. There's missing data because as they do these analytical equipment things, certain observations are just plain messed up, and so you'll have holes in this data set. And just quickly, one of the sort of standard crude ways to deal with missing data and things like this is if there's a missing element in a row, you simply remove that row. Well, in this situation, you've got 20,000 elements in a row. The probability that any element is going to be missing is something on the order of 0.5% or so. So you'd simply remove all your rows, and then you could go home and drink beer, and that'd be the end of the problem. Okay, so we've got missing data, we've got non-normal data, and then we've got outliers. These are measured on little pieces of glass. A little fleck of dust or something gets on there, and it sends the number out the roof. So we've got outliers, missing data, and then N less than P. So we've got our work cut out for us. Okay, how do we do it? I'm going to rip through the algorithm for robust singular value decomposition. So just leave the word robust out for the moment. We're going to talk about singular value decomposition. I'm a geometric kind of a guy, so here's our matrix. We're going to try and approximate this matrix using two vectors. We form the outer product of these two vectors, and it conforms to this. And so our game is just to figure out the elements of these two vectors. We do that in a particularly simple-minded kind of a way. To form the first element here, it's just the product of these two numbers there. So let's focus on this vector and the first row of this matrix, which is just this matrix. What we're going to do is we're going to do linear regression of this column on this vector. And so you should say to me, but Stan, we don't have that vector yet. And so I say, just write down any numbers you want here. Put any numbers you want here, take this, form the linear regression, and this regression coefficient goes right there. Now sweep this column across the matrix, and every time you do it, take the regression coefficient and write it in this element up here. So now we've got our first approximation to the right eigenvector for the singular value decomposition. That's not right, because we started off with junk here. So we simply transpose the whole system, bring this column down here, this column up there, transpose X, and then we do it again. Because now we have, in the transpose matrix, we have a starting approximation to the left eigenvector, or what's now the left eigenvector, and then we iterate back and forth. This has been proven to converge to the correct answer, the least squares answer. Great. Wonderful. So we do linear regression to get our x's and so forth. We switch the left and right eigenvectors. We iterate. We use alternating least squares to do that, and we get the least square solution. Now, if we replace this linear regression in here with a robust method, least trimmed squares, least absolute deviations, now we have a robust singular value decomposition, and now let's pick up our outliers. Suppose this cell is missing. We just compute the linear regression and we skip it. Yes?
Is the convergence proof for the robust regression?
Nope. It's proof for the least squares. There's another weird thing on the robust regression. If you do this, you will get the normalized. You can get your singular value here. The singular values will track. Then once you get this approximation, you subtract this from this and then just do it all over again, and then you stepwise go through and get the system of eigenvectors for your thing. For the robust method, the singular values do not monotonically decrease. They can kind of jump up, and that's a weird sort of part about this process. Okay, well, let's do it for a nice data set. 47 wines were judged by 32 wine experts who remained anonymous. The wines, however, are named, and then there was no data for one wine, so we really just have 46 wines. And there's one missing data point, so that's not much of a problem. And the results that we look at in each cell in this 46 by 32 matrix are the ranks of the wine. Each judge was asked to rank order the 46 wines. And evidently there was one wine bottle which was very, very good and someone stole it. But at least that's my idea. I don't know that that happened. So here's our missing data down here, and here are the wines, and here are the judges. This is just a little heat map, and that looks pretty chaotic. Here are our eigenvectors computed with a robust singular value decomposition. You see a whoppingly big one here going down, and then here's this little jump up. So it looks like there's at least one component, maybe two. But the jump up here is about the same size as there, so we don't really know. So it suggests one or two components can explain this data set. We do another trick. So every now and then there's a trick, so I'll tell you where the tricks are. The trick here is that we rank order the wines by the elements of the eigenvector, first eigenvector, and we rank order the judges by the elements of the eigenvector, right and left eigenvectors. So we've taken a matrix. Our real problem when we started this off was how do you reorder the rows and columns of a matrix so that you can see the patterns that are in the matrix? And we reorder by the elements of the eigenvectors. We've also, you're seeing the outer product here, so you're not seeing any noise. You're just seeing the smooth signal that's picked up by these two eigenvectors, right and left eigenvectors. The judges, if you look, which ones are the judges? Yeah, here are the judges. If you look at the elements of the eigenvectors, they go up, and then they break, and they go up, and then these look kind of constant, and then another break. So I've separated these by eye, but you can use segmentation algorithms to sort of mathematically separate off the groups. And then I've also separated off for the wines into groups, again, by eye, although you can use a segmentation algorithm to do that. And if you do that, you can simultaneously cluster the wines and the judges. A couple of interesting things here. There were several wines that looked to be consistently judged good. Red is good, green is bad. Judged good, and one of the real questions I've had as a sort of a serious wine drinker but not an expert is when I read the literature, someone says, well, this has hints of roses and raspberries and whatever. And I look at that and say, well, these guys, I mean, what have they been smoking? You know, not what have they been drinking? So the real question is, are these experts themselves internally consistent? If you give them a good bottle of wine, will all the experts say, yeah, that's a good bottle of wine? Well, these experts are pretty consistent. But these three judges, this is red up here. You can't see it. I can see it on my computer. This is red. This is green. These three experts come from another planet. Okay? They're not like these. Okay, so you can find interactions in high-dimensional tables. Okay, we're going to turn now to the real problem at hand, and that the real problem at hand is how to relate multiple blocks of data. Not having my hands on a real data set that I wanted from our friends in the pharmaceutical industry, I found a paper on multivariate regression trees, the analysis of abundance data. So there were 12 species of forest trees in the forest. And there were seven categorical predictors. These are things like the slope of the land they live on, the water, the depth of the soil, you know, typical sort of ecology kinds of things. And then this was all done in Missouri. So down in the southeast corner of Missouri, you haven't been there. It is near the end of the earth, okay? You know, the end of the earth is very close to there. So they have a lot of woodland there, and they wanted to know which species would occupy which of these plots of land. They had 275 plots of land, and they had these 12 species, and they had 7 categorical variables with a total of 30 or so various categories. So one categorical variable might just have 2 categories, and another might have 5 or 6. We'll talk a little bit about how other people have done this problem. If you have multivariate Y, here are our 12 species, and then the blocks of data over here can be sort of an ontology of ecology. You can have some data that's related to the wetness in the soil and things like that, other data that's related to solar radiation, other data related to soil types and things like that. So your data, which is describing these plots, will come in blocks of data that relate to certain sort of ways of looking at the problem. So here are your ways of looking at the problem. And now the way the PLS guys look at this is they do a principal components analysis. They wouldn't say this. Any PLS guys here? Okay. Beat up on me later. So they would form a linear combination here to create some pseudo-variables or derived variables, some linear combinations here, and then they'd grab these guys and move them down here, and then they'd relate these to those. And there's a bit of sophistication about how you form the linear combinations and whether, as you're forming these linear combinations, you're simultaneously looking at Y. So there's a lot of fun and games here, all very complicated and all very linear. Okay, here's our data. Here are our 12 species. Here are the predictive variables, land association, river banks, hills, so forth, geology, and I don't know anything about this. Landform, this is like names of mountains, top parts of mountains, top of the mountain, shoulder ridge, shoulder, back slope, meaning behind the sun, bench, so forth, aspect class, this is how the sun is impinging on the thing. So here are our categorical variables, and each one has multiple categories. And our game is to try and group the species profile together based on the site characteristics. And I've rather arbitrarily, for lecture purposes, going to focus on these two things. And then this guy, this species, I don't know what it is, this species is very prominent. And it actually has a lot of variance. So relative to the other species, this one is occurring a lot, and it has high variability. So it looks like it's a variable that we may want to pull out separately, analyze that, and then analyze the rest, which is, in fact, what we'll do. Here's our raw data. Looks pretty chaotic. Here are our species, and here are our 275 plots of ground. So if you looked up a column here, this would be the species profile for that plot of ground. Here's our singular values. You see a whoppingly big one here, and it trails off pretty nicely, and then you see something like a linear thing here. So there may be 1, 2, 3 real singular values, and the rest may simply be noise. We're going to pull this first guy off because it's related to one particular species. You can see that here. Here are the elements of the first eigenvector based on the species, and here's this guy. And you can see, you know, everybody's sort of not doing anything, and then here's this one species where there's a huge change. And then if you look across the 275 plots of ground, here are the elements of the eigenvectors for that side, you can see a gradation. So we're going to pull this species off by itself so we can examine what's hidden underneath the noise of this very prominent variable, response variable. Here are our Y variables, and here's this prominent one, and there may be another one lurking in there. Again, raw data, and what are we doing here? Here are our, we're now looking over on the X side of the problem. So we're looking at our X matrix. First was why. So we've looked at why, we figured out why, at least I think I figured out why, and now we're going to go over and look at x, because we have to figure out how the x's are related to the y's, so we're going to sort of disentangle the x's, get those all shaped up in our head, and now we're going to go look at the x's. So here are the geology, the aspect ratios and things like that coming up here. Here are the 275 plots of ground. And again, this looks it looks kind of weird and kind of stuff. So can we organize that? We're going to organize that by permuting the rows relative to the elements of the left eigenvector and permuting the columns relative to the elements of the right eigenvector. When we do that, and then do the multiplication so that we're looking at the signal, we see a whole whopping block of data which looks close to zero. These are these guys right here. We see a graded response. These are these guys right here. And then we see a few guys here, and I don't know if there's a guy up there lurking up there or not. There must be. There are three of them here. And then looking across this way, again plotting the elements of the eigenvector, I've done this by eye, but this looks like it's going up, flat, up, big area, you know. And so maybe those are realistic. We could certainly, I'm using a lot of imagination as I tell you. We could certainly use a numerical segmentation algorithm to be a little more rigorous about that. Okay, so if we draw in the lines, now we're looking at the second component. So if you take the first component, subtract it off, then you've got a residual matrix, and then you just apply the same technique to the residual matrix and see if you can see a signal there. And so there, we've rearranged the predictor variables against the plots of ground. And again, it's a little, we'll go on to the next one, because it's a place where you can trick yourself. And I was telling some students the other day, you ought to know when you're tricking yourself, because you have to worry that you're tricking your customer. Fortunately, I don't have a customer here. This is just for fun. This is the third component. Now, remember, the third component looked like it was on that linear trend line, so it looks like it's noise. If you look at the third component and rearrange by the elements of the eigenvector, the third component having subtracted off 1 and 2, red, green, green, red. Well, this is sort of what you should expect, and it's what we do expect when we just build a random matrix and then apply this method. So if you're not careful, you would say, oh, there's a pattern here. These locations have low this and high that, and these locations have high this and low that. And in the X space, I guess it's all deterministic, so you'd probably be right. But it's sort of a random kind of a pattern. If you look at the plotting of the elements of the eigenvector, you can see a pretty fairly nice thing going up, maybe some noise going, maybe some real signals here. So at a certain point, you'll get to the place where the signal is pure random, and one of the things that we'd like to know is how to determine that. Right now, we're just using this visual scree plot, and I wish you theoreticians would tell me a better way to do that. Okay. Let's revisit our PLS guys, because they're pretty vigorous. Again, the psychometrician in 61 laid out this problem. John Kettering, a past president of the American Statistical Association, for his PhD thesis, worked on this problem and published it in Biometric in 1971. So there's some literature going way back, and then the PLS people have been working pretty vigorously in this area. And again, they form linear combinations to form derived variables, and then take the derived variables to form a new X matrix, and then use that to predict Y. Problems or potential problems, since there's a PLS person in the room, problems are, this is all linear. Complex analysis and visualization, it hurt my head to read the linear algebra that these people are going through. You guys are probably better at linear algebra than I am, so it may not hurt your head quite as much as mine. And then there's no direct focus on the individual variables. So when you look across here, you have weighting coefficients that tell you how to form the linear derived responses here. So if you figure out what's going on with Y as a function of X1 prime and X2 prime, and you want to know sort of what's doing it at a simplistic level, you then have to map back and look across these coefficients to do it. Okay, crux of the problem. We're going to use recursive partitioning, trees, things like that. I'm assuming everyone's seen trees, so we'll leave some questions if it comes up. So here's our y response. And initially, we're going to look at one y as a function of particular x's in the first block of variables. So if we were doing, disease or something like that over here, these might be the metabolic variables, and these might be the protein variables, and then there might be over here off the screen some genetic variables. So we're going to use the metabolic variables to describe the gene first, and after we've exhausted the information in this block, building our recursive partitioning tree down, we're then going to let the protein variables come in, and then after we've exhausted this information, we're going to let the genetic information come in. As a biologist, think the genes produce the proteins, produce the metabolism, produce the sickness, and so forth. So there's a whole area sort of ontology of biology kind of stuff where you can create an ordering of how you deal with the variables as you bring them into the problem. Potential advantages are it's nonlinear. It's very easy to interpret because you can map from this to particular variables and then from here map over to particular variables. And the focus is on a specific response and specific predictors. The machine learning guys have a thing called multi-relational data mining, and that sort of corresponds to what we're doing here. Sure? Oh, because this X refers to this whole matrix here. So the 1 refers to the first matrix, the 2 refers to the second matrix, but this matrix here, if you looked at the elements, would be XIJ, where I does the rows and J does the columns, and 1 does the blocks of data. Oh, yeah. But there's this common thread in the sense that the experimental unit here carries across all the matrices. That's what makes this work. That's one of the things that makes it work. Okay, so back to our problem. We're going to analyze this data set, this species first, and then we're going to take that out of the data set, and then we're going to analyze this as multivariate. And basically, this target response was picked because it's the most common tree, highest average, and it was selected by the RSVD as being a deterministic variable in that data block. And so we simply do recursive partitioning on the named single variable. It has the highest variance. Soil depth was picked up here. Okay, let's put on our ecology hats for the moment. Soil depth. If you have very shallow soil, you can't store much water, the trees are going to have a hard time. If you have very deep soil, you can store a lot of water, so the trees will have more to deal with. So this is our proxy variable for water, okay? Aspect ratio over here, if you're on the back side of the mountain, the sun you never see the sun. If you're on the front side, you do. So sun and water make sense, determine what's going to happen with a tree. The method I'm using here is based on hypothesis testing as opposed to Gini and other sorts of splitting criteria, and very fast, very slick software from a little company in Montana called Golden Helix. Okay, here's multivariate. So we have a profile for all the remaining species. We do a hoteling t-test to split, and the first variable that comes out is aspect ratio. And that makes sense. If you think about the secondary species in a forest, they're basically getting shaded by their neighbors and fighting for sun and all that kind of crazy stuff. And so aspect ratio makes some sense. They didn't collect, the other thing that's important for species kinds of things is if we humans go in and just chop everything down, Then there's certain trees that come in first and other trees that come in later, and then shade tolerant trees will eventually push up, and then as the other trees die, they'll take over. So, but there was nothing in this data set that talked about that sort of ecological progression, which probably would have been important. So we've done multivariate. Just a quick word on multiple trees, multivariate multiple trees. So we got crazy stuff. If you here are our species, and across multiple trees, aspect ratio was used in 69% of the trees, and phase was used in 52%. The thing that's kind of fun here is that when aspect ratio was used, geology was not used very often. So there was a synergistic antagonism between these two variables, and that probably means that these two variables are correlated with each other. Because if you're in a single tree and you make a split on one variable and there's another highly correlated variable, you've used up the information on the correlated variable and you're just not going to use that variable again. So within the same tree, you can pick up, across multiple trees, you can pick up correlated variables, which is kind of fun, but not great. These are the variables that count. These are the synergistic variables. If you use phase, you automatically seem to use aspect ratio. So these are synergistic variables. These are variables that are used together in combination. And those kinds of variables are really important, but often hard to find unless you have careful techniques for doing it. Okay, in summary, we've been able to identify variable relationships in our Y so that we can drive our analysis into parts that make more sense. The recursive partitioning can be organized and applied in stages so that you can take the ontology knowledge that you have about the blocks of data and bring that into the analysis process. And that's based on subject matter sort of organization. And then, I've mentioned a couple of times, the obvious application in the pharmaceutical industry will be to use genes, proteins, and metabolism in some organized way to predict disease state or whether a drug is working successfully or not. Robust singular value decomposition is covered in a PNAS paper that appeared a couple of years ago. The recursive partitioning, which I've just hinted at, is very sophisticated software from this little company, Golden Helix. The robust singular value decomposition can be downloaded for free and used. It's very sophisticated point-and-click software. Jack Liu and Jun Feng, two postdocs working with me, built that software. And then I'll put in an advertisement for NIST, which is where I work part-time, and SAMHSE, National Institute of Statistical Sciences, and SAMHSE. We're always in the mood for smart, eager postdocs. So if you have some, if you're going to be a postdoc and want a fun place to work, or if you have some postdocs that want to work on interesting applied problems, send them on. And then the quick thing here is analytical stopping rule for the singular value decomposition. But that's a tough problem. And that's it.